Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Like many of us today, my guest wears many hats. He's a creator, a husband, father, teacher, consultant, speaker, coach, golfer, cat human, and the list goes on. And the reason I'm sharing this is because he not only has many roles, he's also super creative and extremely prolific. So that makes him the perfect person to share some of his best practices and insights into realizing your creative dreams, into getting it all done. I'm talking, of course, of Matthew Dix. And today we discuss filling the black holes, living a life of yes, performative productivity, the power of accountability, the importance of gathering your tribe, and much more. In addition to the many roles that I already mentioned, Matthew Dix is primarily a best-selling novelist, nationally recognized storyteller, playwright, communications consultant, award-winning elementary school teacher. Amongst his many other talents, he's won multiple Moth Grand Slam story competitions, and with his wife Alicia created the organization Speak Up. So, you know, you can tell I'm not exaggerating when I say he's super prolific here. This is the second time Matthew's joined us. The first time was about 4 years ago when he wrote Storyworthy. That was his first nonfiction book, I believe, all about engaging others and changing your life through the power of storytelling. And you can find that conversation on our website, conversationslive.net. That's when I became a fan of his work. Matthew's new book is what we're discussing today, and that's called Someday is Today, 22 Simple, Actionable Ways to Propel Your Creative Life. And here's my guest, Matthew Dix. Matthew Dix, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm so pleased to have you back. It's been a few years, but like me, like many others, you wear a lot of hats. Storyteller, author, elementary school teacher, wedding DJ, minister, coach, consultant, speaker. The list is long. And then, of course, you've got all your personal roles on top. And this book, you say, is the answer to a question you get asked all the time. How do you do it? So tell us a little bit about your book, Someday is Today.
Sure. Well, it is the question I get asked so often when I'm speaking in front of people and they sort of figure out my biography. They want to know how I managed to wear all those hats as you described. And I've always felt bad because my thought is always, if you'll give me 10 or 12 hours, I'll explain to you sort of how I've organized my life and my personal philosophy, because I believe anyone can do it. I don't think I'm special in any way. I think I've just sort of relentlessly figured out how to maximize my time and preserve my spirit and make sure that I have momentum at all times. But I never had 10 hours. No one wanted to listen to me, it turns out, for 10 hours, even my wife. And so, you know, I throw out like a strategy or two and they would love it, but I think I give you nothing really. I just give you a couple little ideas. So the book really is the answer to that question, which is ultimately here's 22 different things that I do or ways that I think or, you know, structures that I've created in my life that allow me to accomplish all the things I want to do. I worry all the time about people sort of having dreams, you know, whether that dream is to build a business or spend more time with a family member or pursue a career in the arts. I just think a lot of people in this world, I think most people in the world have dreams, and ultimately those dreams die when they die. And I think the end of life is so filled with regret for so many people. And
right.
The book is sort of it's the attempt to avoid that regret.
Yeah.
I hate the thought that people might, you know, be at the end of their life and be looking back and not be happy. And I want everyone to be happy.
Yes, especially after, you know, everything we've gone through the last few years collectively as a nation, as globally. I mean, there's that phrase by Thoreau, and I've heard you quote this too, you know, most people lead lives of quiet desperation. And when I was doing British literature at college, it was 20 years ago, I went back as a returning student. I was amazed by how many poets and authors from centuries ago were echoing those exact same feelings that, you know, is this all there is? I have to make the most of my life. And I think we can learn a lot from that. And certainly your book has some fantastic advice in there. So really pleased to have you back today. Your wife writes, and I wanted to share this because I loved it. We don't often think of someone who's truly creative as you are as also being a productivity expert. And she calls you a productivity expert, which again, you are to accomplish all this. She says you're brilliant at finding and filling those little black holes of time that we all have, especially if someone's got kids. So talk to us about how you fill those little black holes and what that looks like for you on a regular basis.
Sure. You know, I love that phrase too. She ended up writing the foreword to my book after I finished my book. And when I read it, I said, I wish you had given me that phrase, little black holes. I would have used it in the book, you know, my writing alone. But, you know, she sees it every day. It's essentially the idea that, you know, I write books, for example, and, you know, the impression people always have as a writer is sitting in a coffee shop 5 hours at a time, listening to smooth jazz and, you know, drinking coffee and writing, when the truth is, most of us, if we're smart at least, we're sort of grabbing every minute we can. So when I tell my children to get ready to go to the baseball game, I know that that means that my son's going to take 12 minutes and my daughter's going to take 8 and my wife's going to take 14. And so, you know, I can stand at the door and I can wait for them, or I can sit in the car and wait for them, or I could sort of like just grouse about it, you know, and walk around downstairs and ask everybody why they don't leave their shoes on throughout the day. Why does everyone have to take their shoes off when they walk in the house? I could do all those things, but instead, I just say to myself, well, I can probably write 10 good sentences right now, or I could probably revise that page that I wrote this morning. And so it's just the acknowledgement that our days are so filled with these small increments of time that if you do a little bit of math like I do in the book, you discover that they really add up very quickly. And if you actually make use of them, you can be a lot more productive than you ever imagined. And you're sort of not taking anything out of your life in doing so. You were sort of not even aware that, you know, this time is being lost until you become cognizant of it. So she sees me do it all the time. She sees me, you know, I brush my teeth and put my laundry away simultaneously.
Yeah.
And she stands by the sink and brushes her teeth. And I always say, well, why don't you put your laundry away like I do? And she says, because I'm not interested in getting all the stuff done that you are, but I'm glad I'm married to you because I'm glad you're getting it done. So it's that idea. You got to either marry me or you need to do it for yourself.
Right. Right. So you have a practice called Homework for Life. And we did talk about this last time you were on the show, which was, I believe, 2018. Actually, 423 days since we last spoke. So, and I'm pointing that out for a reason. Because if I had kept up with your Homework for Life practice, which I did adopt for a week or two, I would now have logged the most story-worthy moment from each one of those 423 days and would now have maybe dozens, maybe even hundreds of story-worthy ideas to spark my own creativity and storytelling. So I'm just putting that out there. That's a practice that you've been doing for a long time. How much content do you actually pull from that?
Somebody asked me that recently, a math person, and so I actually went back and looked because, you know, I do spreadsheets of 100 entries at a time. That's not 100 days because most days tend to have more than one entry. So out of every 100 that I post before I move on to a new sheet, about 10% of that content ends up being included in a story, a book, one of my comedy sets, something like that. So about 10% is sort of story worthy, but I'm thrilled to have the other 90% because I really am capturing my days. And it's one of those ideas, again, that when you look back on your life and you wonder where, like, what did I do in 2012? I feel like I wasted that year. If you did Homework for Life and you recorded at least one small thing that you did on that day, you didn't lose the day, and suddenly your life starts to feel a lot fuller
right.
than ever did before. I actually had an 18-year-old come to me at my son's Boy Scout meeting recently, and he's getting ready to graduate high school, and he said at the beginning of the pandemic, his father told him to start doing homework for life. And so for 2 years during the pandemic, he did homework for life, and then he stopped. And just recently, he went back and read the 2 years, and he's so happy to have that two-year period of his life recorded. He said it was so incredible to have the enormous emotional journey that he went through during the pandemic. And he said, I've restarted, and I'm never going to stop now, because now I understand the value. So just, I am so jealous that this 18-year-old is beginning this practice. And, you know, it wasn't something I began until, you know, I sort of created it when I was about 40. So to do it now as a young person,
yeah.
I just can't tell you what the benefits will be.
Yeah, I can see tremendous value in it. And as you've said before, it does not take long. It doesn't have to be, you know, even a coherent sentence. It's ideas. It's you're capturing the essence of whatever that story-worthy moment for you was in the day.
It should take you less than 5 minutes a day, and it doesn't have to be a complete sentence. It really is just the one thing from that day that if you had to remember something, this is the thing I'll remember.
Yeah. So a lot of psychologists, speakers, talk about the power of saying no. We've had many of them on our show. It's really about saying no to the right things, or really the wrong things, people, activities that are simply going to distract or cost us. And we have to learn to say no to those things so that we can say yes to the right things. And you write and talk a lot about living a life of yes. What's your litmus test for saying yes to the right things?
I almost have no litmus test. I sort of am aggressively arguing all the time to say yes to everything, only because I know that the yes you say today can easily be changed into a no tomorrow. I just believe that when you say no to something, even if it seems like the wrong thing, that, you know, the pursuit that you're not that interested in, you close a door rather than taking a peek inside to see what's going on. And as I look back on my life, so often it is the thing I did not want to do. It is the thing I should have said no to in my mind that I forced myself into saying yes that produces amazing results. I have done so many things and created so many things in my life that I never would have had I set a litmus test for myself and really tried to be careful about my time. So instead, I say yes to every single thing with the acknowledgement that that yes can quickly become a no. I can peek my head in the door. I can spend a little bit of time in that room. And then I am totally free to step out of the room and say, I looked at it. I tried it. It was not for me. But I just think no's are very dangerous, because I think that we always assume we know what's best for us, and we sort of have an idea of what the world is. And I don't think either one of those things are true. I think we lack perspective if we keep the doors closed, and I think we tend not to know ourselves as well as we should. So
yeah.
I just believe in an aggressive yes at all times.
I love that. And I echo that the things in my life that have been really worthwhile were things that I could have easily said no to, but I just said, yes, let's go explore. Let's go see what it's all about. And I'm grateful for that. That also goes along with your philosophy of live as though you are 100. And of course, ties into the book title, Someday is Today. Talk to us a little bit about that. I know someday is your least favorite word.
It is. Yeah, someday is a bad word because you run out of them eventually. And I think people don't realize that. I think they lack the understanding that life is fragile. So, you know, when I was 21, I was robbed at gunpoint, and it was a really terrible experience for me. And I was quite certain, you know, I was absolutely certain that I was about to die. And in those final minutes, when I really thought I was coming to an end, I was shocked to discover that I wasn't sad, and I wasn't angry, and I wasn't even afraid. Really, what I was, it was just regret. I was just overwhelmed with regret that I was 21 years old and I had not accomplished anything. And not only because I was 21, but because truly I wasn't living a life that would have allowed me to accomplish very much at that point. And so, you know, I survived that moment, obviously, and I just sort of became obsessed with the the idea that I never want to feel that level of regret again. And what occurred to me was that we're always most aware of what we should be doing later on in life. You know, the 100-year-old version of myself is the one who really understands how I should be spending my time. And so when I have a choice at night between I can go sit down and watch that TV show that everyone's telling me to watch, or I could go, you know, work on my book or record a podcast with my wife or, you know, go build that thing I've been trying to build, when I have those two choices, the television show is deeply appealing to me at that moment. But what I do is I say to myself, well, what would the 100-year-old version want me to do in this case? Would that version of me say, watch the TV show, you deserve it? Or would that person say, you know what, you're going to run out of time. Finish the book because you have a million stories to tell, and someday you're going to run out of time to tell the stories. Mm. And TV is best saved for when you're 70 or 80, when people aren't asking you to do things anymore. You know, when sort of the phone stops ringing, that's when you can turn the TV on. Do it then. So I'm not averse to television. My wife and I watch it. We don't watch much of it. We wish we could watch more. I'm just always thinking, what would the person on his deathbed, the 100-year-old version of me, what would that person want me to do in this moment?
Yes.
And that just helps me make better choices for myself.
Yeah. The one thing about television that I don't watch too much TV, but the one thing that's always stuck in my mind when I very first moved to America, I went to a series, my employer sent me to a series of motivational speakers, you know, Zig Ziglar and Harvey McKay, Dennis Waitley, all the old guys. And one of them, I think it was Dennis Waitley, said, don't come to me and tell me you don't have time to do whatever it is you want to do. How many hours this week did you sit and watch television? And while you're sitting there watching television, you're sitting watching somebody else live their dreams. Get up off your butt and go do it yourself.
Yeah, I love that. I talk to high school students all the time, and I say, you're either going to be a content consumer or a content producer.
Yes.
There's going to have to be people who are the cows who are eating the grass, and then there's going to be people growing the grass. And which would you prefer to be?
Right.
So although I love television, and I think especially in these days, the television that's being made is brilliant, I also know the average American watches, I think, 36 hours last count, 36 hours of television a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, my wife and I, we probably average about 4 or 5 hours a week. And truly, we wish we could watch more, but we just decided to fill our lives with things that are more interesting to us or make us feel better at the end of the day. I don't think 36 hours of television makes anyone feel better at the end of their week.
No, and of course, we've got into this binge-watching habit as a nation, or I think it goes around the globe, actually, where people will literally spend a whole weekend. I think it was Breaking Bad, my producer said, I spent the whole weekend watching Breaking Bad. I'm like, you're in your 30s. You should be out there having fun, doing stuff.
But... yes. We just started watching Stranger Things for the first time. I think it was 4 seasons. And my students asked me, so what episode are you on? And I said, I'm episode 3. And they said, you've been watching for a month. And I said, I know. Well, we don't watch a lot of TV. So, we watch maybe one episode a week, like the old way of watching TV. And they can't believe it. But I say to them, I'm just doing other things. I love the show. I look forward to getting back to it. But I'm just filling my life with things that make me feel better about the world.
Yeah. And going through your book, I mean, there are many things that I was scribbling to myself. It's all marked up and has lots of little tags all over it. You'll be happy to hear. It's always a good sign. I want to talk about perfectionism because this can be crippling. And the need for perfection, you say, almost always leads to inaction. The result of that is that dreams die. It leads to an unfulfilled life. You know, and probably people end up bitter if they don't feel fulfilled. You share a story of a woman you meet at McDonald's, and this made me laugh because this has happened to me as a writer so many times. People go, I want to pick your brain about writing. And you do them the courtesy of having a cup of coffee with them or whatever, and then you find out that then they haven't written a page yet. they just...
Yeah.
they want to short circuit everything and know the whole route before they've even written a page. So talk to us a little bit about that, the difference between, you know, actually getting your butt in the chair and having wanted to have written.
Yeah, it's really odd. I think sometimes what people do is they see the act of creation as an enjoyable, you know, pleasant, fulfilling experience, when the truth is oftentimes the actual making of the thing, whether it's a book or a business or whatever it is, it's hard. It's not an easy process, and it isn't sort of sitting in a coffee shop and drinking, you know, your favorite cappuccino and writing a book. It really does mean you've got to pound away at sentences until they make good paragraphs. And so I think a lot of times what people do, I just met a woman 2 nights ago at my son's picnic at his school, and she said, I've been thinking about writing this book about this child from Kosovo who was my foster daughter for a little while and her experience. And I said, well, why are you thinking about it? You know, I said, thinking about something does nothing, because eventually you'll be dead and all your thoughts are gone. So thinking is only a thing that should be done if you're actually thinking and applying those thoughts to a page while you're doing it. And I just think a lot of people are paralyzed by the idea of, I need to figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. Before I do it. And you know, if you talk to anyone who makes things, regardless of what they're making, we all know that we make terrible things all the time. You know, there's failed businesses all the time. And those people, they pack that business up and they start a new one. Or there's books that I've gotten 20,000 words into and I've decided, you know what, this is not a good book. Mm-hmm. I don't want to read it. Nobody else is going to want to read it. I've made a terrible thing, but it doesn't mean I'm going to not jump into the next thing. I think in the book, one of the phrases I really don't like, one of the expressions is people say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. And I hate that because it assumes that you're going to make something good. And I always say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of progress. Like, just put stuff on the page or start your business plan or work with that clay or whatever you're doing, you just have to start doing it and stop thinking about it. And I do believe that people just think it has to be right before they start. And right. That is a tragedy because they end up making nothing.
Right. And that rightness goes to environment. You know, I've got to have the perfect office, the perfect desk. You say creativity does not like preciousness. I'm wondering how what you call the spotlight effect plays into perfectionism, because I see some correlation with that.
Yeah, you're very right. The spotlight effect is a real scientific principle that's been, you know, studied and demonstrated to be real. It's been proven again and again. Essentially, it's the problem where people think everyone's looking at them and paying attention to them, when in truth, nobody's really paying attention to you at all.
Right.
You know, they've done these amazing experiments where they'll have someone walk into a college classroom wearing the most ridiculous shirt they've ever worn in their life, and then they'll say, how many people in the college class do you think saw you wearing the shirt? And they'll say, well, at least half of them. And it turns out nobody even noticed the shirt or that person in any way whatsoever. So the problem is we end up going out into the world thinking everyone's looking at us. And so we sort of have to make sure that our hair is in the right place and we've got the right shoes on. And, you know, we're looking our best regardless of where we are, when in truth, nobody is looking at us. We are all self-centered creatures that are sort of self-absorbed with our own lives. And we don't notice anything about people. And as soon as we sort of acknowledge that and accept it, suddenly all of the trappings of life that sort of burden us, all of the worries that I can't go out and do this thing looking like this or even feeling like this, all of those things go away. And that just allows for a lot more time. It allows you to, you know, sort of like go to the gym without having to get dressed to go to the gym. You know, those people you see walk into the gym and you think, my God, it took you 45 minutes to get ready to come here and sweat. Like,
right.
Why did you do that?
Right.
And that's 45 minutes that they honestly will never get back in their lives. And I think they think that that is a valuable use of their time. And the spotlight effect tells us it's a terrible use of your time because nobody's looking at you and nobody cares.
Mm, yeah. I want to talk about finding your people, because this is a key thing to anybody's success, I think, is having the right people around you. And you changed the way that you actually wrote when you went on a trip to Nana's, and she didn't have access to technology. So it sounds as though that lack of technology and the nothing to do out there kind of inspired a different approach in you. And you started developing your tribe from there. So talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I was taught in college is that writers sort of plan what they write, that perfectionism again, before they start writing. And so for a while I was trying to write novels that way, and they were all failing. And so at Nana's house in Boca Raton, the first time I visited my wife's grandmother, I didn't have any of my tools to plan ahead. And so I just started writing, frankly, out of boredom, suddenly discovered that one of the ways people write is we don't know what we're doing. We just start writing, and things happen on the page that almost surprise us. And more than half the writers in the world sort of write this way, but you don't often get taught it, because as a teacher, it's hard to teach if the lesson is just do it and stuff will happen, and I'll watch it happen for you. So that happened for me, thankfully. I found my way to write. And what I always think is that I need people in my creative life to both hold me accountable, sort of like expecting my material to be produced at a regular rate, and also I need people to make me feel good about what I'm doing. I think that it's so important if you want to make something, if you want to be a creator, that you have people encouraging you. I think your spirit is just so important. So when I gathered my tribe, my people, I found someone who just does nice things for me. And that person is really important in my life. I know she's not going to help me craft my novel any better. She's not going to give me any insightful advice, but she's just going to tell me how brilliant I am. And she's always going to be a member of my tribe, because that is important. You know, and then I have the friend who sees all my inside humor that nobody else sees, but also can be highly critical in a positive and productive way. And so over the, I guess, the 12 years now I've been writing novels, I've created a spreadsheet of people who I sort of depend upon, and depending on the book I'm writing, that indicates who I'm going to use on a particular book. Or if I'm building a business right now and I have 6 people who I've taken on as advisors, they're just friends who I sort of talk about every step of the way, and there's always one who's very positive and there's one who is very critical, and then there's a bunch in between. I think a lot of times creators are afraid to share things until that thing is perfect, until it's done. My daughter's writing a book right now, and she won't share it with me. She's written, I don't know, maybe 80,000 words, and she hasn't shared a damn word with me.
Oh.
It's killing me. It's crushing my spirit. But she won't share it with me. And I tell her, you need to have a tribe of people. She does. She has some kids actually reading it, which makes me crazy. She won't let her novelist father read her novel. But she has some teenagers reading it for her. But I think creative people need others to hold them accountable, to make them feel good, to know that there's an audience for their work. I think that closing the door and hiding is a bad thing for most creative people.
Yes, definitely. And just as equally as important as finding the right people is getting rid of the what you call the rotten people, because they can be very toxic. And you talk about forgiveness and why that's important to us to be truly free, and of course we need to feel truly free to be truly creative.
I worry, because I know there's people in our lives who aren't good for us in a lot of ways, you know, whether they're jealous or they're just rotten or they're sad and trying to make other people sad around them for whatever reason. And then there's people who just wrong us, people who do bad things to us. And, you know, I give a few strategies on how to handle them, but the best way to do it is forgiveness. If you can forgive someone, which is the hardest thing to do, it's the hardest of my steps to sort of rid yourself of these, you know, terrible people, or at least figure out a way to deal with them. But if you can forgive them, I think that is the best thing to do. And I just actually recently forgave someone who was a real thorn in my side for a long time. And I managed to find forgiveness, and I am so much happier because of it, that I was able to sort of take that wrong off my plate and not have to look at it anymore.
Yeah.
So I think when you can forgive people for what they've done to you, it is the absolute best way to free yourself of that negative emotion.
Yes, it's a little like getting rid of a pebble in your shoe. I want to talk about accountability. Author Barbara Sher said, I think it was her mantra, this is what she was known for, that isolation is the dream killer. Meaning, if you're not accountable to anyone but yourself, well, good luck with that. And you set up your own accountability steps in a number of ways. One of them is by posting your goals on your blog. Tell us how that works for you and why.
Sure. So it starts in November when I start thinking about what my next goals are going to be for the year. And I actually put it out to my readership. I say, what goals do you think I should be looking into that I haven't looked into yet? And I often get great ideas from the people who read my blog about the things I might need to be pursuing that I haven't even occurred to me. And then eventually on New Year's, I post my goals for the year. And I think I have maybe 51 this year sort of goals, and I break them into categories. And then what I do is every month, and the first of every month, I report on my progress of each of those goals on my blog. I originally did it just to sort of make it public, to hold myself accountable. I felt like if I had to publish it, I will feel more accountable. But what happened is some of my most popular blog posts that people read every month are my goal blog posts, which I always think are the most boring of all of them.
That's interesting.
But people love reading them. I think one of the reasons I like reading them is I believe in setting exceptionally high goals so that you fail often. I think if I ever achieve 100% on my goals in a given year, I'll see that as a failure because I didn't challenge myself enough.
Yeah.
So I think right now I'm averaging somewhere in the 60% range in terms of completion of my goals over the last 12 years. And I think people really appreciate someone like me putting out into the world how I failed repeatedly. Because I think we tend to live in a culture where everyone is sort of making themselves look as perfect as possible,
right,
on their social media or wherever they are. They're sort of like putting forth their best self.
Yes.
And I believe in just putting forth my real self. And the amazing thing is that I've had so many people over the years help me accomplish my goals. You know, I'll be trying to work on a goal and it's just not happening for me. And people will offer to do the goal for me. I'll just do that for you. I'll take care of that. Just give it to me and I'll do it, which has been amazing. And then they give me strategies. Like one of my goals this year, oddly, is to take a photograph of my wife and myself, because we never take photographs together. It's always we're taking pictures of the kids or the cat. Or if it's me and her, the kids or the cats are with us. So we just oddly don't have a lot of pictures of just me and her. So my goal was once a week I'm taking a picture of just me and her together. I have yet to do it this year, and it's June. And someone just recently gave me the idea, just give that job to your kids. Tell your kids they have to take a picture at least once a week of you and your wife, and that will solve the problem. And I just told my kids a couple nights ago, this is your job now. You have to help me. And they're so excited about it. They're hoping that they can get ridiculous pictures of the two of us together. But even then, that's going to solve that goal, and that's an idea I did not have for myself.
Right.
It holds me accountable, but it also brings my tribe in and have them helping me do the things that I want to accomplish.
Right. Yeah, I love it. I love it. Well, I have a couple more questions to squeeze in here. One is performative productivity, as you call it. You say leave performative productivity to the female lions. And I love this analogy because, number one, I hadn't heard this updated research on female lions. And two, I'm kind of tired of everyone claiming to be so busy, busy, busy. And if I take a couple of hours off to go kayaking, which is quite honestly where I do a lot of my meditating and, you know, free my brain so I can get inspired and create, they look at you as though you're a slacker. Talk to us a little bit about performative productivity and why we need to ditch that.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll tell you, you go kayaking as often as you need to, because I tell people that the book talks about all the things I do to be as productive as possible, but that productivity results in me being able to play golf with my friends twice a week and going paddleboarding in the summer with my children and spending enormous amounts of time at little league games and things like that. So I sound like sort of a productivity nut, but it allows me the time to do all those wonderful things like the kayaking you're doing.
Right.
But the lions are great because, you know, there was a time when we thought that the male lions were the lazy ones,
because right,
you know, the scientists would observe them sort of never doing anything, and the female lions were out doing all the hunting. And as a man, I always sort of like, I was offended by it. I was upset with the male lions. I felt like, come on, you're not you're making us look bad.
letting the gender down.
Yeah, I shouldn't really be upset that male lions are letting down the male humans, but that's how I felt. But scientists recently discovered that what male lions do is they hunt at night. They hide in the bushes along game trails, and they just wait for the prey to come along, and then they grab the thing that they want to eat. Where female lions hunt during the day out in the savannah, sort of running their butts off, chasing things down so that they can eat. And so the female lion is the example of performance productivity, or doing it in a performative way so that we get to see you doing that work, and we can think that, good job, female lion, you're out there getting that food. Meanwhile, the male lion is just lying around looking like looking like Archie Bunker, looking like somebody who never gets out of his chair. But really, that lion is just relaxing and waiting for the evening when the food walks basically over to him, and he just has to jump out of the bush and eat it. And so you know, being performative in terms of your productivity is a silly thing. It's the idea that I need people to see me working really hard, and that is just ridiculous. Mm. You know, I get up at 4:30 in the morning and do a lot of my writing. No one is watching me at 4:30 in the morning get things done, including my wife or my family members. They don't, you know, they're not even aware of the things I'm getting done. It doesn't matter what we look like or who sees us get the things done that we want to accomplish. It's just getting it done in the way that works best for us.
Right.
And we should not be trying to impress people with the way we do it.
Right. 100% agree on that. I want to end our conversation with hope. A lot of people have lost hope or struggling to keep it alive over the past few years. And without hope, I mean, we're probably living a pretty treadmill kind of life, which gives us even less hope, I think. So what internal resources do you have you drawn on to hold on to hope and keep moving forward? Because you've certainly had a lot of challenges in your own life.
Yeah, I did. I had a very messy period of my life that where I honestly I could have lost hope very easily, and there were days that were great struggles for me. What I like to remind people is that our life is a culmination truly of minutes. It is a giant pile of minutes that will ultimately be our lives. And if we think of it that way in smaller increments, because that's really what it is, we can start to think about how we can make the next minute, the next hour, or the next day better than the day we just led. If we can just improve one thing within the next minute, hour, or day, we can have hope. You know, change doesn't come over the course of a year or a decade. It comes in tiny increments through small changes and choices that we make. And so I have always found hope in the idea that I can make a different choice right now, and that different choice will change the course of my life. It won't change it much, but if you pile up enough of them, you really can start to make a difference in your life, particularly over the course of time. You know, that idea that small choices over time yield enormous results.
Yes.
If you can find a way to save 3 minutes a day over the course of a year, and then use that 3 minutes in a productive way, whether that is building your business or kayaking, whichever one you want to do, in those 3 minutes, if you can make use of that time that you have suddenly saved, you will very rapidly discover that there's much more time to make your dreams come true than you ever realized.
Yeah.
And I think hope comes in that idea that tiny choices piled up will result in remarkable things.
I love it. You also write that as a creative soul, a maker of things, and a person pursuing your dreams, you can't afford to be a pessimist. So we have to be optimistic and keep that hope alive. Love it. Well, Matthew Dix, such a pleasure talking with you. The book is called Someday is Today, 22 Simple Actionable Ways to Propel Your Creative Life, full of really great information. I've read a ton of books on creativity and I took tons away from your work, Matthew. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
I guess what I'd love people to do is to take a moment and think about themselves. I think we spend an enormous amount of our lives thinking about our spouses and children and neighbors and businesses and coworkers. And it's so rare that we afford ourselves the opportunity to sit down and just say, what do I want? How did I end up here? Who am I? And I think if we just afford ourselves the time to do that, we can start to see the path that we might not be on, the one that's sort of calling to us. So just give yourself 10 minutes, sit on a couch, and don't think about anyone but yourself, and try to find the thing inside you that's sort of calling to you, and maybe you're not quite listening yet. And I think actually for women that is more true than for men. I think women tend to be better human beings who spend more time thinking about the world ever than themselves. And so for women, I will say doubly, you deserve to spend more time thinking about yourself and just giving yourself the opportunity to figure out what you want to do with the rest of your life.
That is a great call to action. The book, again, Someday is Today. You can find out much more about Matthew's work at matthewdix.com, matthewdix.com. Matthew, such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's always an honor. I really appreciate it.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.